We are good to go.
I'm Jolene Edmond. I'm a second-year PhD student in rhetoric and composition. I have interest in feminist pedagogy and feminist rhetorics.
Mm-hmm. I'm Nettie Lane. I'm a second-year PhD student here at Florida State, and I have interest in critical pedagogy and social justice.
I'm Mandy Brooks. I'm a second-year MA, and my interest right now is in self-efficacy studies. So, first question for you. How did you get into literacy studies / rhetoric and composition?
I signed up for a Milton class as an undergraduate, and the chair of the department was teaching it. And it turns out it was a 500-level class, so I was the only undergraduate in the class. And he took a liking to me and encouraged me to go to graduate school. And so when I went to graduate school to my master's at Ball State, I was being trained to teach composition by Joe Trimmer. And that's where my interest was sparked. After I finished my MA, I applied to Ohio State because Joe Trimmer had told me that was a good place to go. I'd done some research. I agreed with him. I'd gone over and visited folks. It seemed like a good place to be. And then right before I left, Joe said to me, there have been other people from Ball State who's gone over there, and they've all come back, so don't let them chase you home. So I had a dare on my way out the door, and I never quite forgot that. So, anyway, I got over there, and I started taking women's literature courses and rhetoric and composition courses. And as I mentioned in the preface of my first book, I was reading women's literature, and I was reading the Greeks in terms of rhetoric, and they weren't talking to one another. And it seemed to me that they were talking about similar things, just not to or about one another. And so that became our mission, many of us who were in graduate school at that time. How do we bring these together? And all of that was driven by an interest in women and gender and women having voices and how this all affects teaching composition, because at heart I'm a teacher.
Thank you.
Okay, which scholars in the field have most influenced your thinking?
Well, I suppose when I was in graduate school, I'd have to say Ed Corbett, because the classical rhetoric training. When I was writing my dissertation, which was a rhetorical analysis of the essays of Virginia Woolf and Adrienne Rich, I had to do a stylistic analysis as part of the rhetorical analysis, and he made me count, you know, how many periodic sentences or, you know, all these different stylistic things. And that was before we had the software to do that. So that was tedious, but kind of intriguing at the same time. So Ed Corbett, in terms of the history of rhetoric. Wynn Horner, she was, when I went to the University of Missouri, my first job, she was at Texas Christian, but she lived in Columbia, Missouri. She and her family lived there for many years, and so she was back there a lot. And she became my unofficial mentor. So again, history of rhetoric, but also how to survive as a woman in the field. Her motto that she kept repeating was, don't let the bastards get you down. I've never forgotten that.
Your overall thing.
Jackie Jones Royster was very influential in terms of her writing, because it made me really question how race intersected with feminism and what my own thinking, what I could bring to it, to that question of that intersection. So I'd say those were maybe the three biggest. But, of course, you know, so many. All the prelim lists and all the people you read in the journals, and it's an ongoing conversation. But those were the big three, I would guess.
How about life experiences? How have they shaped your thinking?
Well, when I was writing Rhetorical Listening, I lived in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, which is a very white suburb of Milwaukee. Milwaukee is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. When I went there in 93, it was strictly segregated. By the time I left this past year, it's still segregated, but it's porous. There are people move among the areas in town in ways that they didn't when I first moved there. So that's good, you know, restaurants, theater, you know, art, things like that. People go back and forth across communities. So I think trying to figure out the question of how gender and race intersected, you know, sort of theoretically within the field of rhet comp was, you know, coupled with my daily experience, what does it mean that I'm living in this primarily white town? What does it mean that I'm raising my daughter there? What does it mean that I'm teaching primarily white students? Marquette is trying to diversify, but it's, you know, still an issue. And so the daily, you know, the everyday things, how they informed the theory and how the theory informed the everyday things and made, you know, certain things more visible to me. It was a constant back and forth.
I sort of have an order question, I guess. So when you mentioned that Jacqueline Jones Royster was sort of influential in that intersectionality, and then sort of your everyday life experience, I think, brought that to the forefront. What was the back and forth of that? Was it one and then the other? Was it sort of simultaneous?
Well, I think it... I grew up in a family of Quakers, and my grandfather's farm had a plaque out in front about how it had been a link on the barn had been a link in the Underground Railroad. And so it was something that had always been a point of pride in the family, but then I'd also noted strains of racism in the family. So the not everyone, but... You know,
sure.
So the tension between the pride in this history and then sort of unconscious attitudes, perhaps, is the best way to put it. I'd always been sort of aware of that and wondered about it. So that was a factor. And then when I was writing the Anglo-American Feminist Challenges, that was my tenure book, so I needed to get it out. Right at the last minute, the press called me and said, "So, we noticed that you don't, that all these women are white." And I was like, "Yes, they are." And they said, "Would you like write a chapter on Alice Walker so we could advertise this as multicultural?" And I said, "Well, that's not really Anglo-American. That's a term that was used in particular at the time, and it kind of coded white." I said, "Well, one, that's not the focus of the book, and two, it seems sort of pandering." And they were like, "Well, we're not sure we can publish a book." So, you know, I'm thinking, tenure on the line. They said, "We're not sure we can publish a book that's kind of not multicultural." And then they said to me, "Do you know Shirley Logan?" At the time, I didn't. And they said, "Why don't you call her up? She's publishing a book on African-American women." No white woman in her book, all African-American. But anyway... and see if she thinks it's okay if you publish a book with all about all white women. And I said, "You know, I'm really not going to call her up and say, 'Hey, I'm white, you're black, would you give me permission to, you know,' I said, I just, no." But it did raise the question of why did I react that way, you know? And so I talk a little bit in the book, Rhetorical Listening, in the preface, I lay that out a little bit, some of the assumptions that I thought were brought to bear. And I still think I was right making the decision I did, pragmatically because of tenure, but also theoretically in terms of the frame that had been set up in that book. But it did raise the question of how does whiteness haunt the project? And so that became my way in to start thinking about rhetorical listening.
Thank you. That was really interesting. What classes do you teach? Which are your favorite and why?
Well, this year, because I'm a new head at Purdue, I'm not teaching at all, which, frankly, given everything that's going on at Purdue at the moment, is probably a good thing, because I would not be able to give my full attention to it, and that would hurt my heart. But in the past, at Marquette, when I taught, I mostly taught to the undergraduate writing majors, and so I would teach, my favorite class to teach was a theory of rhetoric course, and we always... We started with the Greeks and would move forward, and then we'd have kind of a mini conference at the end, and students would do their projects and show me how Quintilian is alive and well today or not, and in terms of current events. And so that was always fun for me because I could see, one, that they had internalized the theories because they were talking about them well, but they could also apply them. Apply with quotation marks, not like a cookie cutter, but use them as either heuristics for asking questions about cultural events or as a set of tactics that they could, you know, develop their own kind of rhetorical thinking with. So that was always sort of fun. So.
Did you notice any challenges in that course in terms of addressing diversity issues? Is that something that you brought up at all?
It is, and it's something I wrote about in Rhetoricalism, in the book, the last chapter that's all about pedagogy, and which lists a lot of different tactics for talking about the intersections of gender and whiteness, in particular in the classroom. So yes, I did notice that. There were problems in general because when students sign up for an introduction to poetry class or an introduction to fiction class, they know the genre. When they sign up to a rhetoric class, they're not quite sure what rhetoric is, you know? And then, of course, they read people and there are 8,210 different definitions, and they're like, eh.
It needs to be more specific.
But when you then bring it into questions of diversity, particularly questions of whiteness, and among an all-white group, or largely white group, who... maybe many of them haven't thought about it too much before, and you're making visible that which they haven't really thought about. That becomes a challenge, and that was part of my the drive for this last chapter in my book, because I wanted to lay out particular pedagogical tactics that people could use. And what I discovered over the years is I started out being trained to teach composition, starting in the modes with personal narrative at the beginning and argument at the end. And it always struck me as odd because I thought personal narratives were harder to write in some ways than argument. I always thought that was backwards. But anyway, when talking about issues of diversity, when starting with personal experience, I found counterproductive for my own teaching, because you make people very self-conscious, and then they, especially the white kids, they didn't want to say anything because they're like, oh, I'm a racist, or, you know, somebody's going to think I'm a racist, or whatever. And so what I found to be more productive was not to deny that there are personal experiences, but say, we're not going to start there, we're going to start with language. So let's talk about language coding. So, like, one of the tactics in the last chapter I talk about is one of the activities I do is we would go in and I'd say, okay, so what gets coded white in the United States? And they'd look at me, you know, well, what do you mean? I say, well, what gets coded young in the United States? And they would say, oh, well, you know, at the time, the low genes, or, you know, different styles. And I'd say, okay, so what gets coded white? What gets associated with the term white? And then they were like, food and golf golf clubs and or country clubs. And, you know, then they were on a roll. And, you know, we'd fill the board with this stuff. And I'd turn around and I'd say, how do you know this? I said, do you believe this? You know, and they were like, well, no. I said, you know, do only white people go to country? Well, no. I said, well, where does this come from? And so to make them see that there's a discourse about race and that it's embodied in them, and they can spit it out. Even if they don't believe it, they know what it is. So I'm not asking for their opinion. I'm not asking for what they're thinking. I'm asking them to identify cultural discourses. And at that point, when you can take it to the level of discourse, you can critique the discourse, and what are the potentials of this discourse for different groups of people, and what are the problems for different groups of people. And when you take it away from that, you're not accusing them of doing anything. You're talking about the language within which they're functioning. Gertrude Stein said, language is like an ocean from which we never surface. And so once they become aware of that, then you can talk about it in a discursive fashion that lets you analyze it, and it doesn't deny the effective, it doesn't deny all the ambient stuff around us, but it does give them a focus to talk about it in a guilt-free way, because I find, particularly talking with white students, guilt is the most, I find it the most narcissistic and unproductive, mode of being, you know, because... when you're functioning from guilt, and that's why with rhetorical listening I try to get people from a guilt logic to an accountability logic, because nobody born today is responsible for the beginning of racism. Nobody owned a slave, as some students will say, right? No, but that's really not the point.
Yeah.
And when somebody says, I didn't own a slave, the subject of that sentence is I. It's not a, the subject is not racism, the subject is not oppression, the subject is I. So it's a navel-gazing kind of thing that I want to move people from. So when you get to the discourse, you can make race or oppression or whatever the subject of your sentence, and you talk about that in that way. Do I hope they go home and reflect on themselves and their practices and all of that? Yes. But I'm not making that the assignment. I'm not, I really don't want Road to Damascus papers. You know, I really don't. Oh, I thought this, and now I think, oh, I, you know, I'm cured. No, you know, it doesn't work that way. So anyway, that's a long way around answering your question, but yes, diversity is a challenge. but I tried really hard to come up with tactics that would put it on their radar and then challenge them to think about it and, you know, how they saw it, you know, being played out. And I'll talk more about it this afternoon in my talk.
So what is on your nightstand?
Dave Edgar's The Circle. It's about sort of the takeover of the social discourse by social media and how, you know, junior high behavior of putting a smiley face is now the way you display approval on Facebook and you know, that you're relegated to these like little notes in junior high. And so the way in which social media mediates relationships between people, you know, it's presented as, oh, you know, you have this much more contact, but do you really? And so the book poses some interesting questions that way. And friend gave it to me, so I'm reading it. The other book is Go Set a Watchman, because Purdue does Books and Coffee, and one of the presentations is on that, and I've not read it yet, and I need to.
What do you think is the most important question that students in rhetoric and composition should be considering today?
Well, that answer, I guess, would depend on the time of day and when you catch me.
Yeah. Or maybe one or a few.
I guess I would want them to question how the languages that they are, or the discourses that they are immersed in, shape not just their identity, but their sort of sense, their structure of ethics and decision making for how they behave and perform their own identities and interact with others. I think that's kind of the key question. And I think you can bring the old classical stuff forward with that. I mean, Aristotle's enthymeme and the audience and all of that. It's I'm going to talk about the enthymeme this afternoon. I know it sounds fascinating. If the whole premise of rhetoric is that I only say what I need to say because you as the audience will fill it in, that really raises the question of what can I assume you will fill in? Why can I assume that? What does it mean about insider and outsider groups? Power dynamics among those groups, and that I think translates easily to the question I just posed.
Okay, so last question is, where do you see the field of literacy studies and or rhetoric and composition going?
Well, I'm glad to hear that you said the word rhetoric and composition, because in some places it's just composition studies, and I would hate to see rhetoric fall out. Because of my training at Ohio State, my grand narrative in the field is, of course, that while back in '63 they, you know, had open access and needed to have theoretical grounding for teaching the first-year comp class, so they said, okay, how are we going to do this? And they went back to some of the classical rhetoricians and the 18th century rhetoricians as sort of grounds for designing pedagogy. That, I realize, is not everybody's narrative. There are some composition programs that don't have any kind of rhetorical grounding, and I find that slightly sad because of my own, you know, obsession maybe with rhetoric, but I recognize that the field is larger than that. But I still think rhetoric has to stay in the title of the field, because it's as foundational as anything can be. So I hope that it goes forward with rhetoric being a strong part. And I think it will, but I think obviously the visual, obviously the digital focuses are shifting in terms of that. So we're going to have to develop new theories, and they've done this already, started doing this in visual rhetoric, but you know, you can't just layer Aristotle's theory on top of an image and have it, you know, do this everything it needs to do. You have to look at the actual genres that you're using, and given the way technology is developing, different genres are emerging all the time because of the, you know, of the technology. So theories have to be drawn out of that. So, you know, theories of digital, that kind of thing. I think as technology changes, we're going to be creating more and more theories. I think that's what's going to be happening. I don't think we'll ever get away from the first year writing. Students come into the university, and I think they need that. And it's both a function of high school training, and state by state, that's a little bit different. Certain states have better standards for what's going on. Frankly, the Wisconsin public school system was much better than the Indiana public school system in terms of that. So I don't think that will ever go away. So there's always going to be that connection. And in some ways, given the corporatization of universities these days, at least that's our trump card for needing to exist as English departments. And it's not that literature is going to go the way of classics. I don't believe that, nor do I want it to. But I think writing becomes the way that we all get some sort of purchase within this new model of the university.
Does anybody have any other questions you'd like to?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.